Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Bob/Robert Lindo. We're going to call you Bob.
Okay, that's fine.
How are you, Bob?
I'm fine, Chris, thanks.
Excellent. You're the owner of Camel Valley Winery.
Yeah, I am, yeah.
And Camel Valley down in Cornwall?
In Cornwall, yeah.
I think probably the top vineyard in the UK at the moment.
It's very kind of you, thank you.
But, you know, you're doing really well. And also a bit of a against the grain, really. A lot of people associate all the top English vineyards with being, you know, in that sort of chalk escarpment below the M25. Yeah. And you guys are way down in Cornwall.
Yeah.
Oh, we had Sam Lindo, your son, on the show about 3 years ago, I think, and he was winemaker. He'd just been made winemaker of the year, which is quite nice.
He's won it since, won it again since. He won it last year as well.
Yeah, you've been winning awards left, right, and centre. And the last year, this year, for the, what is it called? The
Bonaccini del Monte,
Bonaccini del Monte. I terrible pronunciation for that one.
That's a really big competition because they choose the winners of all the competitions around the world and invite them to enter for the World Championship, they call it.
Oh, okay. Is that how it works? So it's not just any old buddy.
No. They invite you to join. They invite you to, and they even pay for samples.
They even pay for
and transport.
Really?
Yeah, everything.
Oh my goodness me, that is it. That's a bit unusual.
Well, the chair of judges this time was Tom Stevenson, so it's a good level of judge and competition and everything.
Yeah, okay. I didn't realize they pay for samples.
Yeah.
And do they charge you for entry?
No.
Because that's normally a lot of the competitions make a lot of money.
I know,
but
they're not a money making competition. That's the interesting thing. They take it very seriously.
Okay. You've won that now, twice for the rosé category?
We won it twice, and we won the international trophy twice as well. So we won 4 trophies there so far.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very good. So you must be pretty happy about that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, going back to talking about soils and things, I think that if you look at competition results when you get to blind tastings, you can start to really draw a few conclusions. And maybe it doesn't make any difference too much, the soil. Maybe it does, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe aging doesn't make as much difference as people think. I mean, we just won the judgment in Parsons Green with the youngest wine in the competition.
Okay, when you say aging, you mean on lees?
On the lees, aging, yeah.
So on the dead yeast, is it wine aging?
See, there's lots of received wisdoms that I think, you know, you talk about me being in the RAF. I mean, I left when I was very young. I was in my mid-30s, and I came with a very questioning attitude to everything. And we didn't do anything that we didn't find a good reason for. And if we were going to age them for 3 years, we'd need to prove to ourselves that was worthwhile. And we've tried it and don't think it is.
How long do you age your wines?
15 months.
15 months. Yeah, because a lot of people would say that the autolysis doesn't really start properly, but your wines, not necessarily your rosés, but your other normal wines have a reasonable amount of autolysis.
They do, because we're not looking for too much. We're not trying to be champagne at all. What we're trying to do is have a fruit-forward style with a hint of those brioche flavours and things as well, which I think we pretty much achieve, really. We're trying to be distinctive and different. I often say on tours, there's 480 million bottles of champagne made. They don't need another 20,000 bottles from Cornwall, you know. There's enough.
Yeah. Where in Cornwall are you?
We're right in the middle, the very, very centre of Cornwall. So we're as far from the sea as you can get, which isn't far.
I thought you were on the west coast.
No, we're right in the middle. 10 miles from the north coast, 10 miles from the south coast.
Oh, yeah, Cornwall, though, so you're not far from the coast.
Exactly, it's tiny anyway.
Okay, and what sort of soils have you got?
It's a slate soil. It's an ancient slate subsoil, good drainage, good depth of soil, and a very, very good drainage. And I think if you go around the world, that's really what separates vineyard soils from other soils is drainage.
Yeah.
Because all the soils vary throughout the world, and people make claims for them, but what they all have is drainage.
Yeah.
And that, I think, basically it boils down to drainage.
I had a interview with a geologist who said, look, he was the guy behind citing Denbys where they were.
Yeah.
Richard Siddle. Anyway, he seemed to think, you know, the main thing is porosity and permeability.
Yeah.
How much water flows through it and how much water it holds.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was quite focused on that. Although, I've always been a bit skeptical about soils, although I'm coming around to it that clay does make richer wines.
What I will say is we've been doing some trials on still wines on a particular area of the vineyard. And not only did we find empirically that customers found a difference, we actually had found wine writers drawing the conclusions that we'd sort of thought, and we've just now submitted one of the wines for the first protected designated origin of a small area. Because it's a Bacchus still wine, but it does tend to, people do say it has more minerality, it's flintier, it's sort of crisper.
That's your delicate. Anne's vineyard, isn't it?
No, well, that's next to Anne's vineyard. Annie's vineyard is the one my wife has pruned her whole life.
Yep.
And she got to 100,000 vines pruned, so we made that anniversary wine that's out there now. Sam made it on the 21st vintage on the 100,000th vine for her.
So. Okay.
And he won a gold medal, which is great.
Oh, that's good. So what are you saying, that this particular chunk of soil you think is unique, or what is it, zone slate again?
Well, it's, if you, to get a protected designated origin, what you need to do is to show a significant difference, not just in soil geology aspect, height, orientation, all these things, but also in actual flavor difference. So it's no good saying, well, it's got all these differences, but it tastes the same as that one. There actually has to be discernible differences. Now, I was as big a skeptic as you could probably be on all of this, but I've been won over. but see, this is still wines. When you're not got the secondary fermentation and the autolysis.
Yeah,
and
you're
all
not
the
adding
other things.
Flavor to it.
No, you're not. So you're just getting a real expression, really, of still wines, I think.
Okay, interesting. What's the winery vineyard area called, or what's the wine called?
Darnibol. Darnibol.
Oh, I haven't tried that. Well, is it here today?
It's here today, and again, a gold medal winner, and it's very interesting because we make a tiny amount of it, and we handpick it. We have a very tight regime for it. The production level is very low. Everything is as tight as it can be, no sweetening, nothing. Mm-hmm. Try and get one, at least one true expression of the soil of one part of the vineyard for interest, really.
I noticed this year at the English Trade Tasting, there was a lot of wines with PDO and PGI coming in, and you hadn't really seen that as a designation in the past. Does that mean that everybody who's got PDO on their wine, it's a unique PDO?
No, it's no. England.
I thought
they
so.
They should say PDO England.
Yeah.
They shouldn't just say PDO. I mean, I'm not being critical because early
it's
days.
It's a bit like saying Appellation Controller. It's an Appellation Controller wine, but is it Bordeaux or Champagne?
Yeah, exactly. You're quite right. They should add. In fact, it occurred to me when I saw that. That's it's not misleading because it's too early for people to understand what it all means anyway, quite frankly. But I think that if we're going to use PDO, we have to say what it is.
And what's your unique PDO? What's it
Darnibol.
Called? Darnibol. Okay.
And that's the ancient field name on the deeds, and that's how it's going to be. That's the only one in England that isn't England PDO. All the others are England PDOs.
Okay. Oh, okay. I wasn't quite sure because it wasn't on the sheet there, sure if it was because they were talking about breaking things out by county as well, Kent and.
Well, even then, you can't do that now unless you file a separate county PDO and show a difference in flavours. So
okay.
That's for someone to do sometime.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So we've blazed a trail with Darnibol to prove it can be done.
Okay.
And now it's up to other people to do it with other areas, counties, chalk, whatever they. Feels appropriate, really.
Okay, well, I'll have a look at that wine. I've done all the sparkling and I've done the rosé, still rosés, and I've still got a lot of white wines to drink or trial.
I had to stop before I got that far. I got too many for me.
Yeah, I had to let it have a break, let my teeth recover a wee bit. But one thing you've got this year is probably the largest English wine I've ever seen in a Methusia bottle.
Yes, yes.
And that's a massive bottle. How many litres in one of those?
That's 6 litres, 8 bottles.
8 bottles of normal wine.
Yeah.
That's a big bottle, isn't it?
It is, and it was just an idea, really. We wanted to celebrate for the Jubilee and the Olympics and all the other stuff and do something completely different.
It's a rosé in there, isn't
it? It's a rosé, but we can do anything in there.
And what wine have you got, and what wine are you using for that? Well,
2010 Pinot Noir Rosé Sparkling,
okay,
which is the one that won the judgment in Parsons Green recently. They came top of 90 English sparkling wines, and the one that tasting that... I think Jancis Robinson was at, and Stephen Sparrier were at, and so that's a really good wine, I think.
I haven't heard of the Judgment in Parsons Green.
Haven't you?
No.
Well, it's the thing that grew up with Stephen Skelton, who's a master of wine.
Judgment in Paris.
Judgment in Paris, and it's the second year of it, and they had as well as Stephen and Jancis, there were another 4 or 5 masters of wine, and also. Waitrose and Marks and Spencers were there, and they tasted 90 sparkling wines, including some champagnes. And I maybe shouldn't say, but the highest champagne came 35th.
Really?
One extremely well-known champagne that I won't mention in case they get embarrassed came 89th.
Yeah.
So English sparkling wines all did really well, and that rosé came top, which is fantastic.
So, okay, but you're doing that for any of your wines, or just the...
Well, we do them to order. So we announced 6 on Twitter, and they sold out overnight. So now we've got a waiting list, and we're saying to people, you can, we'll do what you want in that bottle.
How long do you think they'll keep in that bottle? Because people talk about bigger format bottles keeping for longer because you've got less air seepage and a lot more wine to mop it up.
Yeah, yeah.
I was quite tempted to buy one, actually.
You're quite tempted.
I was tempted.
Well, interestingly, what's spurring people on, and this, of course, is very unlikely to happen, but some of the limited editions of Methuselahs for the past are selling for fortunes.
Yeah, well, that's
right. And these are the first ones in Britain I know of that have ever been done.
Yeah.
So, and they're numbered. So maybe in years to come,
might be worth something.
Who knows?
Particularly if you win another Bonaccini award Del Mondo, with it.
Yeah.
So,
but we can't. I think next year we've been asked if we'd step aside and judge instead.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is really good because that'd be interesting. I'll enjoy that.
Okay. Well, that is a shame you can't enter again.
Yeah, I think they're sick of us.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. We were talking earlier about down in Cornwall and that, and there's not a lot of other wineries down there, which is a bit of a surprise.
That's great, isn't it?
Well, it's good for you. That means you get a bit of a... Right, but you described it as Fortress Campbell.
Fortress Campbell. I mean, because people in Cornwall are very territorial in a nice way, I think, on the whole, in a nice way, and the local food and drink concept in Cornwall is a big deal. It really is. I mean, we've got loads of wonderful restaurants, Rick Stein, Nathan Outlaw, Nick Barclay, loads of really, really good restaurants, and people look for it in Cornwall, and I think other sparkling wines have found it very difficult to get a foothold there because everyone in Cornwall over the last 25 years has visited us and they have an intense loyalty to us, which is lovely, you know.
But what about, why hasn't other people set up in Cornwall perhaps?
Well, I think there are very few parts of Cornwall that actually fit the bill. You know, I think if you're much closer to the sea, you've got too much salt influence and wind influence. And I think if you're you haven't got a steep south-facing slope, and there aren't many of those in Cornwall. You know, there's two or three river valleys, and that's it, really. There just, I don't think there are many opportunities in Cornwall, to be honest.
Okay.
We just happened to own the farm that fitted the bill, really. We're just so lucky.
Yeah, how did you land up? Were you farming normal?
Well, what happened was I left the Air Force very young. I had an accident, a mid-air collision. I ejected and broke my spine, from which I've recovered, as you can see today. And we went into farming. We bought the farm there. My wife and I, we're very young, so mid-30s, no handlebar moustaches or anything when I left the area. And we farmed for a few years. And the place really is a warm spot. And over the period of a few years, it works on you. And we planted the vines. And I am very thankful to the pioneers that sometimes get laughed at, you know, the retired colonels of the past and all that, because those guys actually assembled masses of data. Masses of track record of what they tried, what they hadn't tried. They'd all written at least three books each. They used to say at one stage, there's more books written on English wine than there was bottles of English wine every year.
Certainly good bottles of English wine back then.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a bit of a joke though, wasn't it? You know, it's like, old retired colonel, retires, sets himself up a vineyard, producing a couple of rows of vineyards of absolutely diabolical plonk, simply because they'd never done any formal training.
Well, I don't think it's even that. I think it's a myriad of things. And the first thing is, if you're the first person to try something, these guys were the pioneers, you know. I mean, they were the first people to try growing grapes, the first people to try making wine. I mean, they've got to go through this learning process, discovery process. When people like me came along, there were already courses in the 80s. You could do a course. So even at that stage, those people had required a course, and there was someone providing it, a lady called Gillian Piax. I've still got her book, and I still refer to it. They still got really good stuff in, and a lot of it's in really good depth. And, you know, it's a bit spasmodic, but, you know, those guys were the pioneers, and I'm very grateful to them.
You shouldn't give the old retired colonels...
No, I wouldn't, honestly, because none of us would be here without them. Because I don't think anybody would have taken this on without seeing some evidence that some of these guys had had some success. I mean, when you talk about the quality of the wine, you also got to go back to the era of what people... how good people were at drinking and how much they drank and how much tasted wine. They weren't actually very good at it.
Yep.
So not only were people not making particularly good wine, wine wasn't very good. Mm. People don't realize how much wine's improved over the last 30 years anyway. I mean, you go into the supermarket and buy a bottle of wine, it's not going to be faulty.
Yeah.
It's definitely not going to be faulty. You go in the supermarket 30 years ago, you probably find quite a few of them. That's why they invented wine writers in those days. You needed one to tell you which one you could drink.
Yeah, true. True, it does become less of a problem, isn't it?
Yes, it does.
Especially with supermarket wines, they're all starting to become a bit more homogenised.
Yeah.
Okay, now that's cool. What do you think is the future for you guys down in Cornwall? If you don't think you're going to get a sort of a core group of producers down there. No. Are you always going to be that sort of slightly maverick, producing nice wines?
I couldn't put it better. That's what I love. Embracing the counter culture in Cornwall is where we see ourselves. You know, like just being a little bit different. Being, you know, some Americans came and did a film for American Travel Channel, and they described Cornwall as the California of England. And that's sort of a lovely way to feel of it. It may not be true, but it's a lovely way to feel of it. You know, it's somewhere a bit different.
Yeah.
But I grew up in Suffolk, which is the other side of England, and I always thought Cornwall was a foreign country as I grew up, before I realized and did a bit of geography. I thought it was overseas somewhere. You grew up with that funny feeling, and it's still like that.
And what do you think your future, though, is? Is it, can you plant more? Are you going to grow? Are you quite happy with your size?
We're quite happy with our size, and I think the lessons... You know, you don't have to be very bright to look around the wine world and see the biggest mistake you can make, and it's called overproduction. And I think what, and if you do the maths, if you take the fixed costs off, which are things like duty and VAT, and as well as all the bottles and corks and whatever, then when you're biased towards a very low profit margin at a low price, and as the price increases a bit, then you have to make far fewer bottles to have this, to enjoy the same returns. So basically, high quality, small production is the way to protect yourself in a big market. So when all of this English wine comes flooding on the market over the next few years, if it does, if it all comes flooding on,
it will come on,
it'll be nothing to do with us, because we won't be competing with mass wines, big labels. We'll still be that off-the-wall place in Cornwall, on second generation now, been going 30 years. People have been coming back for 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, we'll get some new people tomorrow, but we'll also get people from over that 30-year spectrum.
What do you think in the next 5 years for English wine as a general rule? You mentioned that there's a lot of volume coming on, and I remember predicting 2012 was the year that big volume starts to come through. So by the time it's been made into wine and spent time on the lees, 2012 was supposed to be the year that a lot of volume hits the shelves. Well, and it's going to continue for the next
year. Well, interestingly, you see, you would have made an assumption that many of the high volume producers make incorrectly, which is they don't take into account the historic low yields in England. Now, if you go back to these pioneers, they recorded all this. An average yield over all the time since records have been kept is 1 ton to the acre. That's the average yield. Now, if you were a top producer in Burgundy, you'd be producing more than 1 ton to the acre, even if you're trying to limit it. So these are people trying to get the most they can. So trying to get the most you can, it's 1 ton to the acre. That means however much you plant, however many acres you plant, other than in very good years, every fourth year we reckon is a very good year, where you will get the normal yields, 3 or 4 or 5 tons to the acre. The rest of the time, you'll get 1 ton to the acre. And that was what will limit the explosion in English wine. This year so far is very much like 1997, which was a terrible, terrible year, with almost no grapes produced over the whole of the country. Well, it's looking like that in 2012.
Yeah, because
it may not happen. I mean, you know, you can't see the future, but I wouldn't be surprised if this was a very low volume vintage.
And is that the because flower set will be coming up soon? Well, if it's raining through,
we haven't even hardly got bud bursts because the weather's so bad.
Yeah,
it's so cold and so wet. There's hardly buds to see.
No, I've got bud bursts in my back garden.
Yeah, okay, a bit of bud burst. But normally this time of the year, you're looking at 9 inches of growth by now. You know, Cornwall anyway. Whereas we're looking at little tiny buds, you know.
Yeah,
they'll catch up if the weather turns nice, but maybe it won't turn nice. And I think, I'm not a pessimist, I'm an optimist. I've planted grapes and vineyards in England, but I do think people get carried away with the yields. They're not going to be the same as the rest of the wine-producing world.
Okay.
Which could be a good thing.
So you don't think the volumes that may come on, they'll land up getting evened out over
time?
In the end,
there'll be overproduction, but it'll be a slower rise to overproduction than is usual.
Okay.
That's how I would put it. If you look at New Zealand, you know, the rise to overproduction was quite rapid.
Well, it took 20 years, but...
that's quite rapid, because when you think about it, from zero to hero in 20, or whatever you want to call it, in 20 years, it's pretty rapid for a new region to be a £10 a bottle wine to a £5 a bottle wine in 5 years. That's less of an achievement, but that's the inevitable consequence of overproduction. Many of the brands have joined the other supermarket brands, and nobody buys some of those brands when they're full price ever. When they go back to £9.20, people think, well, okay, that'll be £6.46 next week, and they wait for it, £6.46. So the price becomes £6.46. You can never go back.
Yeah.
So with overproduction, but you can see why people do it, because let's imagine you'd made 1 million bottles of sparkling wine that you couldn't sell. Well, actually, if you sold it for £5 a bottle plus duty, that's £5 million. That's quite a lot of money. So yeah. You can see that people can get a good return, a loss at that stage sometimes, or at least recoup a lot of their investment. But that drives prices down, I think.
So you're not as worried, but you still think there's an issue.
I think we've been going long enough. You know, we're established enough and stable enough that we will take whatever it comes. We can retreat into Fortress Cornwall if we need to.
Yeah.
Have the best wine bar in the world if we want to. So we try to be broadly based.
We buy a bit of your wine.
Good, good.
Yeah, not masses, but a wee bit. I think your pricing is all right, you know, because you've got good quality, you know, really.
Thank you.
Usually your wines are either the best or up there with the best.
Well, thank you very much.
And your pricing is normally a smidgen above everybody else's, but not massively over compared to some producers whose wines aren't quite good, but the prices are astronomical.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you provide good value, but where you are, we always find when we buy some wine from you, it costs us almost as much to get the stuff up from Cornwall.
Well, listen, I tell you, there's an interesting point on pricing that I think you touched on. You can't just pick a price. You can't plant some vines, grow some grapes, make some wine, and say it's £24.50. How we got to our price is by over the years, whenever things were selling out too rapidly to last the season, we raised the price to stem the flow. So the price is built on a historical succession of shortages. It's not just picked out the blue. So the price sort of has been made by the market in genuinely, you know. Whereas I think one of the things I would be very worried about as a new producer is looking at the prices of Ridgeview, Cumber Valley, Knight Timber, Chapel Down, and saying, well, that's my price. Well, that's their price after 20 years.
Yeah.
And after having, like we must have had in that period, maybe somewhere in the region of 200,000 visitors that we've spoken to on tours directly. That's how we got that price. So I would be much more concerned if I was starting today that I would think my price, I would have to build it rather than choose it.
There's some big vineyards getting planted at the moment. I was down visiting Rathvinny during their planting season, and they're going to be fairly big. And they're going to need a while to get a mature market. It reminds me very much of Yealands in New Zealand, if you've heard of Yealands.
Yeah, I have.
They planted a massive vineyard, and it just came on stream 2007, 2008. Yeah. Bang, the market fell out of the industry. Yeah. They did all right. They've managed to survive it, but I think they've been pretty focused and very commercial.
Well, a lot of people are very heavily financially backed, and those people will make it work, because I think the loss of face is pretty hard to bear for successful people.
Yep.
So they will make it work. Whether they'll make it work and it will be profitable is another matter. But for me, the other thing that's very important is I still like to be hands-on. I like to meet people. I like to work in vineyards. I like to drive tractors. I like to clean tanks. I like to be here today. I wouldn't want a layer of management between me and all that.
Yeah.
So that I never got to do that.
Yeah.
So for me, my biggest concern, if I had all of that to do today, would be that I wouldn't enjoy it. The involvement would be too remote.
Yeah, it becomes more management accountancy.
Exactly. Whereas for us, I mean, I often say to people, you know, when it's my turn, I'll clean the toilet. I don't care.
Yeah.
We're all doing the, sharing the tasks, and that's one of the tasks. But actually, it's quite nice to look back to see a nice clean toilet when you clean it. You know, it's not that bad a job, you know.
Great, I've got a house full of them.
But what I mean, it's better than
checking them on the way out.
It's better than being stuck in a hot, sticky office in the summer. Do you know what I mean?
It's better to
get your hands dirty and get and do stuff. You know?
Yeah,
is what I like to do. I like to do stuff.
Yeah.
And the idea of other people doing stuff and me telling them to do stuff the whole time, I'm sitting in an office not doing anything, would be like a nightmare.
Okay.
I'd hate that.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Bob. Thank you very much for your time.
I'm not coming to Twickenham.
Cheers, bud. Cheers.